Welcome to the CMO Marketing Podcast, where we interview business owners, leaders, or marketing professionals to find out their lessons and stories for success.
Welcome to the CMO Marketing Podcast, episode number 101. And thank you very much for tuning in to listen to this podcast. This one is going to be a little bit different, and I'm going to explain to you very quickly why this is going to be different, and then I shall be launching in to the podcast. I don't have a guest today. I don't have anyone to interview, talk to, ask any questions of. Number 101 is simply going to be about me, and I'll explain a couple of things about that. I've been extremely hesitant about recording this episode because I didn't want it to be perceived as any sort of arrogance or egotistical kind of posturing, and I didn't really want to talk about me, despite, for those of you that know me, that you might think the complete opposite of me. I didn't really want to talk about things that have happened to me in the past, the how I got to where I got to today, mainly because I don't think I've really achieved anything, and I certainly don't think I've achieved anything of any particular note. Some people might disagree with me. I'm fairly confident that, you know, there are lots and lots and lots of people out there who do substantially better than I do, and have stories that are much, much more worth telling than mine is. So with all that in mind, I didn't really want to record this because I don't think it's particularly interesting. I don't think anybody wants to hear it. And yeah, I kind of went, what's the point? Two things occurred to me. Number one was the interview I did with Lou Jury, which was in the 90s, was just before Christmas. Lou's somebody that I've followed for many years, I've known for many years, and I've admired what he's done and what he's built and how he has reached where he is, you know, the business level he's reached. And Lou and I crossed paths many times. He has the same age as me or similar age to me. And in his podcast, he talked about having a plan. And he talked about having a plan from an early age and 10-year plans. And now he's on his second 10-year plan or his third 10-year plan, something like that. And that kind of blew my mind because as I joke with someone else today, I said, I don't have a plan. I rarely have a plan of what I do on a particular day. And again, I might be exaggerating there, but I certainly don't have the sort of 10-year plans ahead of me that Lou has ahead of him, which sort of made me think about other people and other businesses. And it kind of concerns me that people that hear this idea that Lou had a 10-year plan and he's now on his third 10-year plan, it might terrify some business owners when they hear that, who don't have that plan, who can probably barely put their shoes on in the morning, you know, who might have crippling anxiety before they go to bed, who might wake up in the middle of the night wondering or being concerned about not having enough money or being paying the bills or under relationship stresses or all those kind of things. And that's by no means a criticism of Lou for having a 10-year plan, but I wanted to do this podcast to explain to people that you can create a business, you can have your own autonomy and live your own life and make some money, and you can do all those things without having to have this vision, a plan ahead of you. And that just because somebody, you know, like Lou, who is ultimately extremely successful, has that plan, there are many people that don't have plans and still become successful. And this is the purpose of one of the reasons for telling this story. The second reason was, perhaps more ironic, was me getting into an argument on Twitter, which again, for those that know me, is not normally, you know, it's something that happens on a fairly regular basis. And I was getting into an argument on Twitter with somebody who had gone through some business struggles themselves and made some very poor decisions, in my opinion, and wouldn't listen to anybody else's advice and was, you know, not going to go into the depths of somebody else's story. And in the midst of the argument, he'd accused me of the same thing, making poor decisions and this. And I kind of went, well, I know I did. I'm cognizant that I've made those poor decisions. I have admitted them. And after that argument, I kind of went, well, maybe I haven't really admitted them, or maybe I haven't really admitted them properly. Maybe I've, you know, done them piecemeal here and there, but nobody knows the real full story. So in some respects, the next however many minutes of this podcast are some level of absolution or confession or something to sort of say, you know, this is the story. This is how I got to where I got to at 46 years old and 47 in April. And, you know, this is, these are the decisions I've made in my life, and these are the mistakes I've made in my life that have got me to where I am today. And it's, those are my talk two core reasons for doing this. So essentially what you're about to hear is a potted history of me, Simon Dell. And again, for you, those of you that know me, some of this may not be a mystery whatsoever, Sim. You may know all of this. I actually doubt any of you know all of this. But for those of you that don't know me, hopefully you will find something interesting or useful out of this that can help you in terms of your business, your marketing, wherever you are in your life at the moment. For those of you who don't want to listen to this, you've already listened to 7 minutes of it. I honestly have no issues if anybody switches off now. If you don't want to listen to this, you know, and you think this is going to be boring as batshit, go ahead, switch off. This isn't about me doing this. I am doing this for hopefully help people out there, but I'm actually kind of doing this for myself in terms of, you know, in terms of that sort of confessional, you know, release of sitting there going, yeah, right, look, I've made some bad decisions and I want to tell the world about them. So that's what this is about. And that's my little introduction. So with all that in view, I'm just going to sort of launch straight into it. The way I'm going to do this is just going to, which is what I normally, the way I normally talk is I'm going to tell some stories and I'm going to wander off in a various tangent. I'm probably going to forget how I went off on that tangent, drag myself back to the point of the story. The first thing I want to say is that I had a very strong work ethic from a kid. I had a paper round at 11. I used to get these local newspapers delivered in massive bundles, and I had to come back to my house like three or four times in the round because I simply couldn't carry the whole lot all the way around. Until I realized the best solution was to load them all into a wheelbarrow and walk them around the streets wheeling a wheelbarrow and then going in and out of the houses to deliver the papers, which means I only had to do one journey and it made things a lot quicker. I did that job. I did a cleaning job for my father. My father worked in an office, and downstairs in the office was a printing company, a big warehouse. And I used to go in there Saturday mornings and clean the warehouse and sweep it and hoover it, and clean the toilets. I did anywhere that I could earn a bit of money, because for me, I was earning money so that I could then go and spend it. And I used to buy a lot of records and buy a lot of CDs, as you do in the late 80s, early 90s. So I used to, you know, do that, get my money, go into what was HMV at the time in Bromley, in Kent, in the UK, and then spend all the money on my, you know, whatever music that I wanted to buy, and then take that home on Saturday afternoons and sit and listen to it. And that kind of kept me really, really happy. That was, you know, what I enjoyed doing. And then when I went to university, probably there's another step back there, but I'll talk about university in a second. Then when I went to university, I was working in the bar at university. Then in the holiday times, I would work in the pub, local pub, the Railway Hotel in West Wickham, which was an amazing, amazing classic British pub. And the guys used to come in there at lunchtime, and two stories I remember from this pub. Number one, the guys that used to come in at lunchtime on a Tuesday and drink 6 pints of Carlsberg Export. And for any of you that's ever drunk Carlsberg Export, I think it's only about 5%, but fuck, like 6 pints could knock over an elephant. These guys used to come in and they'd be on the dot at midday and they'd drink 6 pints of Carlsberg Export in 2 hours. Then they'd leave the pub, get back in their car and drive back to work. And I'm like, how the hell did they, these people did this every single day? Like, where did the money come from? And how the hell could they, you know, drink driving was still, I mean, obviously it was frowned on back then, but it wasn't sort of cracked down on as much as it is today. But yeah, that was mental. Just never forget those guys. One guy in particular used to do that all the time. And the other story that's, again, I've completely gone off on a tangent here, as I said I would, it's nothing to do with marketing whatsoever, was that the pub used to have this jukebox, and it was one of those automatic jukeboxes where all the CDs were downstairs in the basement, and it just used to play various random tracks over the speakers throughout the day. And I used to come in the holidays, in the summer holidays, and do the lunch shift, which was like 11:30 till 2:30 or 3:00 or whatever it was. And you'd do it on your own because it wasn't a busy pub during the lunchtime. It wasn't a busy pub full stop, but it wasn't a busy pub during the lunchtimes, and one person behind the bar could handle it. And I remember coming in on one Monday and the CD system had, it was broken to the point where it was only playing one song over and over again. I mean, it had a database of CDs and something like 3,000, 4,000 songs in there. But for some reason, the system had broken and would only play one song. And it was Rod Stewart's Maggie May. And I don't know for any of you that know the song. I'm not going to try and sing it, please. It's not going to happen. But if you don't know it, I know that song better than I know the Lord's Prayer. And I said the Lord's Prayer every morning at school for 7 years. I can tell you every lyric of Maggie May by Rod Stewart. It haunts me. It haunts me to this day. I hear it on the radio and I have to turn the radio off. I get a cold sweat. Cannot listen to it. So there we go. That was my first tangent. I've gone off on Rod Stewart's Maggie May. So one of my first points, things I wanted to say, was about my university. I went to university and I have a double degree in law and politics. And some of you that might know me might go, what the fuck? But I do. I do have a double degree in law and politics. And the politics side of things was all about UK and US political systems, law. I did various different segments, constitutional, criminal, contract, property, blah, 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 blah. And I have no idea to this day why I picked those subjects. I'm sure there was some sort of reasoning. I kind of had some sort of idea what I think I wanted to be. I think I wanted to be a lawyer. In fact, I know I wanted to be a lawyer, and that was what I thought I was going to be. And then I think it dawned on me really, really quickly. For any of you that have studied law or know anything about law, the textbooks that you get in a law degree are just insane. They're just horrible. They're like, yeah, it's just no fun whatsoever. So I got these textbooks and it very quickly dawned on me that I wasn't actually going to be any good at doing law. And I kind of spent 3 years blundering my way through a degree, got a 2-2, which kind of is you're all right, but you could have done better degree. Came out of university and just went, well, that was a fantastic, giant, massive waste of time. I say that as a criticism, but perhaps it wasn't a waste of time. Perhaps I did learn stuff out of it. Maybe there were some things that I picked up on it. I probably could remember two or three lessons from my university career or learnings that would actually be worth me remembering today, but I genuinely don't think it was a good use of 3 years. Perhaps what the better use of the 3 years was the social side of things, because I, played in some sports teams, organized some parties, had a lot of fun, met a lot of friends, went out to a lot of nightclubs, drank a lot of beer, and made some friends there that I still have to today. And I'm a long way away from them and I don't get to see them very often, or if at all. But, people that I would not see for 3 or 4 years and then meet up and be, like it was the 3 or 4 years hadn't passed. So university was good from that kind of experience. And then when I went out of university, I sort of realized that, I wasn't going to go into law, certainly wasn't going to go into politics. I did actually have one kind of brief flirt with politics. I was the junior common room president in my halls of residence for a couple of years. But that kind of really just meant organizing parties. That was pretty much what that job did. And that was fun. But then I ran for the treasurer position at the student union, and I ran against a guy called Charlie, I think. And he had this big network of people that were out there campaigning for him. I didn't really have anyone. I had a girlfriend at the time, a couple of mates, but nobody really sort of helped me out. And I remember being in the counting room at something like 2 a.m. because it was all done like a proper election, like with counting rooms and, and announcements and all this kind of thing. And I was somewhere in the counting room at 2 a.m. to find out that Charlie had beaten me to the treasurer position by something like 15 votes or some entirely, incredibly narrow margin. And the returning officer, because even the student union has a returning officer, had turned around to me and said, look, that's tiny, smaller margin. You are obligated, not obligated. You are well within your rights to ask for a recount. And I was like, oh, fuck, it's 2 a.m. I just want to go to bed. And I'm like, nah, it's all right. Let Charlie do it. I don't want to do it. And that's it. Walked out. And that was the end of my political career. It kind of made me realize, and I still to this day, I had this conversation with someone the other day. I can't understand why politicians do it, because, the pay's shit and everyone gives you grief all the time. So I don't understand why you'd want to be a politician. I came out of university, got a couple of crappy jobs. I sold some clothes in a department store for a bit, for about 6 weeks. I got a management training position with Bass Brewers. They taught me how to manage pubs. That's a sharp learning curve. You know, all of a sudden you're responsible for money and people who are drinking alcohol and security guards, and you're 21 years old, 22 years old, and it's, yeah, that's a steep learning curve. But pretty quickly, they started letting me do relief management, which is where some pub managers would go on holiday and I would go and cover them for 2 weeks and look after the pub and make sure things were right. And yeah, it was fun. I'm still 22, 23. I was living in Southampton, traveling around the South Coast, Bournemouth, Southampton, Portsmouth, those kind of areas, looking after other people's pubs. I think I did two or three relief management shifts, and then I was an assistant manager or a trainee assistant manager or something in a pub in Bournemouth. So that was sort of my first, you know, real experience of, you know, management, real life business, and to a slight degree marketing, because pubs need to be marketed. And it was, you know, it was fun. It was a bit lonely. Pub management is, you know, you're working on Friday, Saturday nights. Your mates are out on a Friday, Saturday night, so you're not seeing them. You're not taking part in them. I was living with a house with my friends in Southampton, so they wanted to go out. They want to go out on Friday, Saturday. But I was working, and I wanted to go out on a Monday or Tuesday, and they were working. So that kind of, you know, that was a major problem. And then I got a chance to move to London, and I got a job in management at a nightclub called Equinox. And there's a couple of stories that I always tell about Equinox. I'm not going to say here because they're both quite violent and they might get people in trouble. But Equinox was a giant 2,000 capacity nightclub in central London. It was run by a company called First Leisure. And I went in there, I think I went in there as the food and beverage manager. Then I became the assistant manager. Can't remember. I was on the license. So to go through the whole Westminster licenses processing thing. They gave us a house to live in, which is one of the reasons I moved up to London, was because they kind of went, well, we realize how expensive it is to live in London. And this was like in the late 90s. And they said, we've got a house, which was a massive terrace house in Surrey Quays. It was a brand new, it was beautiful, it was well maintained. You shared it with all the other managers. It was nice enough and it was free rent. The hours were absolutely dog shit crazy. You used to have to be in at 3 p.m. and you rarely finished before 2, 3 a.m., sometimes even later, 4 a.m. So you were doing 11, 12-hour days on a regular basis. And again, that didn't bother me. My work ethic wasn't a problem. You're doing these 50-hour weeks, and then towards Christmas, you had to start, instead of starting at 3 p.m., you'd start at 1 p.m., and you might be there for another hour afterwards because corporate gigs, bigger club nights. Fridays and Saturdays, we didn't shut till 5 a.m. Maybe it was 3 a.m. I can't remember. It was just mental. And then the nights off, which were Monday and Tuesday nights, you went around to all the other nightclubs where all the other managers worked and got free drinks and got completely smashed. And yeah, it was a fun lifestyle whilst you were still young. That went on for a bit. That gets very tiring very quickly. As I say, the culturally working those hours gets draining. I was offered a assistant manager job at a place called the Roadhouse, which is quite famous. It's in Covent Garden. It's now actually closed down. I think COVID finally killed it. Small nightclub, 600 capacity, but it used to be open for a lot longer, 5 p.m. through till 3 a.m. And it used to turn over its customer base multiple times. Live music, cocktail staff. Again, shit happened there. All sorts of stuff happened there that, again, I'm not going to repeat because get people in trouble. Saw somebody have a heart attack on the dance floor. That was probably quite a defining moment. And we all sat there looking at this guy as he's collapsing on the floor going, what the fuck do we do? And fortunately, one of the security staff sort of stepped in and took over. But it was amazing how quickly you realize I've got no capacity to deal with this sort of thing at all. And you just freeze. And all of a sudden, you're watching somebody potentially dying on the floor, which is, you know, quite a scary prospect. But I'm glad to say he didn't die. It was a relatively minor heart attack, but still a heart attack nonetheless. That was one story. The other one was Lemmy used to come in there. Lemmy from Motorhead. And anyway, Lemmy from Motorhead used to come in the Roadhouse, but it was a regular occurrence. He'd come in once a month and he'd play the pinball machines because the Roadhouse had about 3 or 4 pinball machines, which were on rotation. So there's always different pinball machines in there every month. Lemmy just used to come in and drink bottled beers and just stand for a couple of hours and put pound after pound after pound into the pinball machines. It's, I laugh because I look back on it now and go, that's what a, just a bizarre experience. Lemmy from Motorhead is there. And he made it specifically clear, he didn't want anyone talking to him. He wasn't signing any autographs or anything like that. Lemmy from Motorhead was just sitting there playing pinball machines. Bizarre experience. This is a cornerstone moment of my life where I go, everything that's happened from this point onwards, I kind of think stemmed from a single point that in one night when I was working at the Roadhouse. And actually, it wasn't a night that I was working at the Roadhouse. It was a night that I had off. And I knew the son, a guy called Barney, who's the son of one of the owners of Stringfellows. So anyone that knows Stringfellows or Peter Stringfellow, it was a strip club. It was a big famous nightclub in the 80s, 90s, and then it became a strip club. And it was, I think when we were going there, it was transitioning from a nightclub to a strip club. Like, it was a strip club some nights of the week and it was a nightclub other nights of the week. And Barney was a mate of mine who used to work there. And again, lots of stories about Barney, but those are Barney's stories. They're not my stories. But we used to go in there and Barney would shout us a few drinks and we'd buy some drinks and we'd watch the strippers and then Barney would finish and we'd go for a beer somewhere else. And one night there was a girl that I was interested in who was also working at the Roadhouse. And this was in the early days of mobile phones. So when I went to university, there was no mobile phones and mobile phones were sort of coming of age in the late 90s. So I had a mobile phone and I think she'd sent me a message, whatever it was. I was there with Barney drinking in Stringfellows and I got this message that she was in the Tiger in on Haymarket just off Piccadilly Circus. And I have a feeling Tiger is still there, but it may not be. And she'd made it sort of specifically clear that if I came along and had a drink with her, blah, 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 things might happen, et cetera, et cetera. So there I am at 1 a.m. in Stringfellows. And I said to Barney, look, I'm going to go to Tiger. I'm going to see this girl. I'll catch up with you later. Left Stringfellows, which is in Covent Garden, walked across to across Leicester Square, Piccadilly Circus, down Haymarket to Tiger. Get to the front door and there's one security guy in there. He's kind of smaller than me, stocky, probably some European, somewhere in Europe. And he takes one look at me and ushers me straight through the door. And I'm like, okay, whatever. Get through the door. There's a counter just inside there, a reception counter, and there's nobody there. There's a little sign that says it's $5 to £5 to get in. And I'm like, that's all right. It's 1 o'clock. I understand cover charges. We charged a cover charge and I had the money. And there was nobody there to take the money. Most normal people, because there was no other security there, most normal people would just walk into the nightclub or put the £5 on there, not pay the I just walk into the club, right? As most normal people. I worked in nightclubs, so I kind of felt some sort of level of obligation to give them the £5. So I walked back out and saw the doorman there. And this was a Tuesday night, so Haymarket, Leicester Square, Piccadilly Circus wasn't busy. I mean, it's middle of London and it's always busy, but it wasn't extremely busy then. And I gave this guy, and I said to the doorman, I said, there's no one on the counter. What do you want me to do with the £5? And he looked at me and said, I'll just give it to me. I'll give it to the receptionist later on. At that point, I'd worked in a number of nightclubs. I had some level of disregard for security staff. And I said to him, no, mate, you're just going to put that in your pocket and no one's ever going to see it again. And the moment I accused him of that, he's then gone, right, well, you're not going to the nightclub. Cut a long story short, me and him ended up actually, I could say it was a fight, but it wasn't a fight. It was like two grown man babies wrestling on the floor of Haymarket. And he, to his credit, he's a security guard. He could have just given me a good old clump and no one would have noticed. But I was trying to get his badge. He was trying to fend me off. We ended up rolling about on the floor. Prior to that, I'd done something insanely stupid, right? Story of my life. When he said I couldn't come in, because I was a licensee, a Westminster Council licensee, right? And I was a licensee of Roadhouse. I rang the police. Honestly, the dumb hurts me just saying those words. I rang the police to complain at 1:30 in the morning that this doorman was trying to steal money from. No evidence of this other than he said he was going to give it to someone later on. I complained to the police that this doorman was trying to steal money from this nightclub. And I suggested they come and arrest him straight away. I mean, I'd been drinking. That's no excuse. Alcohol is no excuse for acting like a dick at any point. But I called the police. Now, they hadn't turned up. So, of course, at that point, I tried to take matters into my own hand and get his security license off the chest of his jacket. And that had then turned into me and him rolling about on the floor like two man babies. It was at that point that the police turned up. They hadn't been there for 20 minutes and they turn up just as I'm rolling about on the floor with him and promptly arrested me, put me in cuffs. The police station in Westminster, I can't remember where it is, but if you're in Leicester Square, there's a police station not far away. I was going to say it's Bow Street, but that's in a different direction, so it's not that. It's a famous police station, I can't remember where it is, right? But suffice to say, from Haymarket, it's about 2-3 blocks walk, right? And this policeman cuffed me and walked me to the police station. Didn't even bother putting me in the back of a van, but walked me to the police station and charged me with drunken disorderly and chucked me in a cell. And all the movies and TV shows, you get one phone call. So it's probably about 2:30 in the morning by now. So it's Tuesday night, the middle of the night. I'm 24 or 5 years old by that point. Yeah, 24, 25, something like that. I've hopefully tempered that over the years. But anyway, I get a phone call. So who did I ring? I rang my dad. So my dad at 2:30 in the morning is talking to the police officer. The police officer is apparently telling my dad that I was just drunk and being a prick. My dad's had a word with him. I don't know the conversation that's gone on. The policeman they've charged me. They've let me go. And they charged me with drunken disorderly and sent me home. I had to go to court 2-3 weeks later. My employers were obviously extremely pissed that as a Westminster licensee, I was getting drunk and getting into fights with doormen, and that could jeopardize my license. It could jeopardize their license, which is even worse. They were pissed with me. I think I took 2 weeks holiday, did the court case, was there on a bench in Bow Street Magistrates. That's where I was at that time. And they were, it was me and a row of prostitutes on this bench in this court, waiting for the magistrate to deal with us. And each prostitute was going in there and getting fined. And I walked in there and got something that's called bound over to keep the peace, which means essentially you're not, no criminal record, no charge, no, nothing against your name. But essentially what they say is, you were a dick, don't be a dick again. And if you are a dick again, we're going to bring up this charge and probably do something about it, which means you're going to get charged with two things next time. So they bound you over to keep the peace for a year. And after a year, they forget everything that happened. So essentially, I hadn't been charged with anything. I hadn't been found guilty of anything. I wasn't scot-free, but that was the point. I went back to work the next day. They said to me, look, you can't be a magistrate anymore. You can't be a licensee anymore for Westminster. Just, it's bad. We can't have you here whilst people are, whilst Westminster are examining our license. We need to remove you off it. And they kind of tried to fire me or give me a reduced job. And I was like, well, I hadn't actually done anything. I had done something wrong. So let's not get that right. I had actually done something wrong, but I hadn't been found guilty of it. And I knew technically they couldn't use that against me because I'd only been bound over to keep the peace. Cut a long story short, ended up in the job in their head office earning the same money that I was earning in the nightclub. And that was, they pissed them off. But they actually gave me a job in head office, which was marketing and events. And that's kind of where I started understanding about marketing. I was building websites. I was managing database, doing e-newsletters, helping them with production of all sorts of event material, helping them set up events. That was fun. That stuff was super, super fun. And I learned a huge amount. And I look back on it now and I go, yeah, kind of got actually a fortuitous moment getting arrested. It was a dumb as fuck moment. I accept that. But it was also a fortuitous moment that if I stayed doing what I was doing, two things wouldn't have happened. Number one, I wouldn't have had to get a chance for marketing. And I also got a chance to do some marketing for some of their other restaurants as well. I wouldn't have had a chance to do that. And I also wouldn't have been in the club the night I met my first wife, who was there on a hen's night. And if I hadn't met my first wife on that night, I would never have got married to her and I would never emigrated to Australia and I would never be here today. It's one of those sliding door moments, that Gwyneth Paltrow sliding door moment, which was that if I hadn't done the dumbest thing in my life and tackling the security guard, I wouldn't be here in Australia. I mean, maybe I would, maybe I would have found another way here. But everything that happened that night has kind of come from that single moment. I ended up working there for a few years. I then started moving into a corporate job, Bass Brewers. I got a sales job for Bass Brewers. They made Carling. For those in the UK would know Carling Lager. It was massive. It sponsored the Premiership. It was a huge, huge brand. I got a sales job there. I was traveling around Southeast the UK, all the way down to the coast, all the way up in London, selling beer to pubs, which is actually a harder job than it sounds because lots of contracts involved, lots of loyalty to certain brands, to certain breweries. It was a fairly competitive market back then. Stella was absolutely massive. Kronenbourg was absolutely massive. That's what people wanted to drink. Carling, it had the sponsorship, but it was more bigger up north than it was down in the south. Yeah, so it was a much more corporate environment. It was a proper sales role, you know, laptop, car, mobile phone, sales meetings, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Learned huge amount about sales. And I think of all that time, probably the major lesson that taught me there was the ability to adapt yourself to your audience. So for example, I might spend the day talking to somebody who owned a pub down on the South Coast and they're fairly relaxed, they're a middle-aged couple, or they might be a semi-retired couple, they're pretty chilled, you know, they just want to have a chat and talk to you and, you know, they might want a free umbrella or something, whatever, but it's, you know, it's not easy. You still got to convince them, but, you know, that's a fairly easy sales call versus the times when I'd be perhaps in London, in Southeast London, in Deptford, in some of the roughest neighborhoods and pubs in the country, certainly in London, and the sort of places that you might go into and think, oh, I might not be coming out here alive if I do something wrong. And as a young guy, you might be kind of thinking those things through your head. You know, probably it's a load of rubbish, and that's not the case, but you kind of think that. And I think one of those, again, defining moments was me, was we did a deal with a nightclub in London, which was a new nightclub. It had renovated. It renovated a big warehouse building. Somebody had spent a lot of money on it. And we went in and did a deal to stock some of our brands. One of those brands was Grolsch at the time, a Dutch brand, big competitor to Heineken, or small competitor to Heineken in the great scheme of things. But Grolsch, great little brand. Everyone knows the Grolsch pop top bottles and all those kind of things. And this nightclub opened. They had all of our products in the fridge. They had some massive weekends and they came to want to order again from me. And they rang me up and said, well, we need this amount of this amount of Grolsch. We need this, and this. And I tried to place the order and their account had been frozen because they hadn't paid for the first order. And eventually the second order went. They still hadn't paid for the first order. They never paid for the second order. They wanted to order a third order. I had to go in there and tell them that they couldn't have any more beer and ask them for the money. And it was at that point when I went in for that meeting, because it was in the daytime. I hadn't really seen the club in the daytime. I'd only really been in their evenings and night times and all those kind of things. And I saw these guys and I went into their office and I kind of went, fuck, these guys are gangster as fuck. And I was like, these guys, they're not going to give you the money unless they absolutely want to give you the money. And that's quite a confronting experience. And, you know, again, I was 25, 26 by that point and asking people for money that they didn't want to give you. That's hard. But it taught me the power of adjusting to the circumstances, the ability to sell, the ability to talk to people at their level, you know, the capacity for negotiation, the capacity to ask for something, to close a sale and get agreement with people when you might not both be on exactly the same wavelength. It taught me a lot. And I think it was a fantastic experience doing that. I think I learned a lot. I ended up getting married. We emigrated to Australia in 2001. 2003. Now, 2003. So it was the middle of the Rugby World Cup in 2003, the one that England won with Johnny Wilkinson. Hooray! Left behind the UK, ended up getting a job here with Heineken. A guy called Nick employed me, lovely guy. Still seeing him around every now and again, Nick Bainbrigg. Ended up working with a couple of other great guys as well. And Heineken, and we existed in Heineken for about 6 months. And they were coming off the back of the Rugby World Cup, so pretty much they were all hungover for the first month I worked there. And then Heineken got bought out in Australia by Lion Nathan at the time. And we went to work at the Castlemaine Brewery. And I was in sales there, and I was in sales there for about 3 years. Lots and lots of stories about that. Again, not all of them mine, so I can't really tell them all. But a great experience. Fantastic brands to work for, 4X, 2E's, Heineken. I worked in various sales teams there, some of them in the, outside in the suburbs of Brisbane, some of them in the centre. We did some good stuff. I spent some time with the State of Origin team, which for those of you that aren't in Australia won't have any clue what that means. I was on their coach one evening from the hotel to the stadium, which was amazing. I was in the changing rooms 2 times after they won State of Origin matches, which is a great place to be. Yeah, lots of fantastic experiences. And I left that place because, try and make this story quick. They do these psychological tests, lifestyle inventory tests. They're, some of you may have done them. They kind of measure your personality and then try and give you areas to improve and things like that. And I did one when I started with Lion, and it was basically very red, which means you're aggressive, you're argumentative, you're a hard person to work with in a team. And basically, they don't want people who are like that. They want people who are blue, which is that you're helpful and supportive and team focused and blah, blah, blah. And then there's also the green people who are passive sheep, do as they're told. And what they really want is people that have got a little bit of everything, predominantly blue, but a little bit of red and a little bit of green. And I was all red, no green, tiny little bit of blue. And I did that. And that's obviously a red flag to them to go, right, this guy's going to be a problem. And I did another one 3.5 years later after I can't remember why I did it the second time. Something had happened. There was a couple of stories in that time where I got in trouble for things that I shouldn't have got in trouble for. It wasn't my fault, but something had happened and a guy called Andy came up and he was human resources from Sydney. He came and chat with me. We did the test again, which is where other people do it for you and you get the results. And it was actually worse. It was actually worse 3.5 years later than it was the day that I'd started working with Lion. And I remember him clear as the day saying to me, you got 2 choices. He said, I can help you work on this and we can improve on this and you can develop and you can get better. And then he kind of paused and sucked in his breath through his teeth and looked at me dead in the eye and said, that's if you really want to change. And he kind of knew that I wasn't going to. He knew me too well. He knew I wasn't going to change and certainly not in the way that Lion wanted me to change. And at that point, I kind of went, right, I'm going to quit. And I quit and I actually gave him 3 months notice. And I started my own business. I went out as a consultant. My first business was called Straight Edge. It was marketing consultancy. And the reason I did that was I'd read a book by a guy called Richard Lamar. It was actually co-written, but I can never remember the other guy's name. Richard Lamar wrote a book called Punk Marketing. It was all about the rules of marketing have all changed and there's the 12 new rules of marketing. And I read it on a plane coming back from the US with my wife at the time. And I went, fuck, this is what I think marketing should be. And I'd been doing marketing for a year, little backstory there. I'd moved from a sales role to a marketing role within Lion. And the other thing was they'd offered me a job in Sydney. Or they said I could look at going to work in Sydney, and my wife didn't want to go and work in Sydney, but I don't think they really wanted to keep me in Brisbane. So it was like, you should probably leave. And that was where this had all stemmed from. But I'd read this book by Richard, went out as a consultant. It was called Punk Marketing. Straight Edge is a subset of punk, for any of you that know punk and punk music and what Straight Edge means. Did this consultancy for 9 months, a year, badly, no idea what I was doing. Absolutely. I spent most of my time, those 9 months a year, sat at home in my underpants. My wife was out working. She was getting a pretty well paid job. She allowed me the flexibility to kind of explore being a consultant. I had no idea how I was pricing myself. I had no idea what I was actually doing. I had no strategy behind anything. I'd just gone, let's go and do marketing consultancy. And my God, I see that so much now as people are going, let's start a business. We don't really know what we're doing. And that was me. And I did that for a year. I did it so badly. I built my own website. It was just absolutely diabolical. And I don't think I earned much money that year at all. I had some clients. I had no plan of how I was going to get clients. There was people that I knew, and I was doing some speaking, but it was just a schmozzle. There's a word you don't hear often. It was a schmozzle. And an old contact of mine in Lyon who'd left Lyon and started up another company importing beer from New Zealand. He rang me one January and said, do you want to be the state manager for Queensland? I took that job because it was very well paid and it had a car. And it was kind of there maybe it was a bit earlier on, but that work ethic that I'd previously had seems to have vanished at some point in my life. I can't really pinpoint where that happened. I don't know. Maybe I can. I don't know. You know, I think I'd had when I worked at the Roadhouse and I'd worked at Bass Brewers, I'd had a series of questionable bosses, people that kind of made me feel pretty shit about myself. And I think over time, I don't think it was one particular moment. I think over time, I'd just sort of be browbeaten into not really wanting to work hard because you just got the shit kicked out of you metaphorically and in one case, literally. So I don't know. So maybe that sort of that work ethic had vanished and I got this state manager job and I wasn't really invested in it. I didn't want to do the sales calls because I'd kind of seen myself go beyond that. I didn't want to do sales calls anymore. I did not a great job that year. I was distracted, not focused, not particularly interested in the job. I had a couple of staff members who were fairly low paid, not overly invested in the job themselves. We were working with brands that the Queensland market wasn't overly enthusiastic about. Premium beer up here in Queensland wasn't a massive thing. Yeah, it was hard. And I did that for a year. And then there was a point, and I'm not going to forget, I'm not going to remember when this is, maybe it was 2008, late end of 2008, start 2009. In the space of about 2 or 3 months, they fired me and I separated from my wife and we sold our house. And I think I'm sure it was 2008, 2009. And bizarrely, my poor parents and I never, ever, I feel so sorry that they got dragged through it. They were here visiting at the time when this all happened. And I remember coming home to them and just saying, I've just been fired. And I think 2 weeks prior, my wife had moved out of the house. And it was just a massively tumultuous point in my life. And I, bizarrely about the job, I felt quite good about it because they'd given me 3 months notice. I'd stopped working straight away. They'd let me keep the car. I have to pay the money off myself. But I kind of felt good about it. I think it was because I was doing that job for a year and I really shouldn't have been doing that job for a year. I shouldn't have ever taken it. I shouldn't have gone back into sales. It was the wrong people to work for, just not me. And I went and met a guy, and I'm never going to remember where I met this guy, but I wanted to start a marketing agency. I think I met him at a networking event. I wanted to start a marketing agency, a proper marketing agency. I'd done the consultancy thing. I'd gone, yeah, you made a dog's breakfast of this. Let's try and do it a bit better. Let's get into bed, metaphorically again. That's definitely not literally. Let's get into bed with someone who's already got a business and can help you out. I met this guy introduced through somebody who was running a web development agency and he allowed me to use his office. We created a business that was 2 cents and it was a marketing agency. And basically we would do everything that a marketing agency would do except the web development, which his other company would do. And me and him were 50-50 business partners. And this is my first major lesson in business, aside from the one where you don't know what you're doing. Not to get into business with people that you don't know. Now, my first business partner, again, I'm not going to mention his name. If he ever listens to this, he knows who he is. I cannot speak anything bad about the guy, right? And I won't. The thing with us is that we just weren't the right people to be working together. We were too much similarities between the two of us, and we were the wrong people to be in business with each other. So that turned out to be a complete and utter disaster. And I eventually ended up buying the business, him out of the business. We made a series of poor decisions. I kind of thought that we knew how the business was being run. This was a classic one. Was I think the third month that we were in business, we sent an invoice out for about $25,000. And I was sitting back in a chair going, fuck, right, this is how easy it is. We've made it. And then the rest of the business coming in, we didn't have an understanding of the pipeline. Where was the other leads coming from? Where were we getting more business from? It was just so badly run. Bad focus, no plan, no understanding of how cash flow worked and profit and loss and paying tax properly and on time, all those kind of things. The continuing theme right up to the point where I've met my current business partner, Matt Clarkson, the continuing theme in my life was the inability to get my head around the technical aspects of running a business, how things should be done if you want to stay in business, if you want to stay with your head above water. Cash flow, paying wages, paying superannuation, tax, insurance, all those things that you need to do to run a business. But you don't think about that because you're a marketing guy and your job is like, let's get the next client in, let's go and find new clients. You don't, the technical side of things, you don't worry about. And again, this is where the element of absolution sort of comes in. That first business ended up going into administration. And again, I'm not going to go behind the reasons why it was, but that first iteration of 2 cents went into administration. The administrators came in, we did a deal, we traded it out of administration. We then shut that company down. We had another company that was trading at the same time. That was the company that we were running. Again, that was the one I ended up selling. And there's a story here because, again, I accept all blame for this complete fuck up, right? And I accept the blame that we had a company that was making lots of money. And there was some months where we made over $100,000, $120,000. You know, so not a massive amount of money, but for a small agency, that was good. My second business partner, my third business partner, the three core business partners I had over my life, one of them was very brief, sort of more of a consultant than a business partner. So probably two business partners, just the wrong people for me to be in business with. Great people on their own, very skilled at what they do. They have their own lives and journeys and whatever. Just the worst people for me to be in business with. And the second 2 cents company, when was it? Probably late 2014, when somebody came and offered to buy 2 cents. It was a software implementation company came and offered to buy 2 cents. And I was like, fuck, I need to get out of this. Just, it was a series of just poorly run. It was just, I can't probably say this enough times. It was just really badly done. We were making money, but for some unknown reason, I felt that success was defined by the amount of staff we had. I kept employing more staff. I had staff that was sitting there probably earning me $500 a week, and I was paying them three times that. It was just not three times that, twice that. It was just really, really bad. We sold the business in January 2015, and the people that bought it took over running it in February. I exited the business in March, and that business went into administration, I think, June, July of that year, 2015. It went into administration purely because I had left it and sold it in a state. It was in debt. It owed money. And I'd made this, I'm not going to go into this, but we'd given all that information to the people buying it, and We thought they'd done their due diligence and understood what they were buying. Turns out they didn't and hadn't. They put it into administration. Yeah, it was not a good time. And it was just when my first son had been born as well. So there was all sorts of stuff happening there. It was when you kind of have those failures and all of a sudden, a year later, 2 years later, the ATO were on my back and the ATO wanted a huge amount of money from me. And you have a young son, you're trying to have a second child, and you're a consultant on your own, and you've seen these massive business failures happen in the past, and you've recognized, or you're starting to recognize, that despite the denial of the past, the only person that really is to blame is yourself, because you've made the poor decisions in the start, the poor decisions of hiring more people or getting into business with the wrong people or whatever it is. Not taking responsibility for things, it just kind of heaps on top of you. And for all of those business coaches out there, the success stories and building massive business empires, and you too can be this successful and fucking Tony Robbins walking on coals and all that shit, right? There is thousands, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of business people out there that are constantly under the stress of making poor decisions, of not knowing what decisions to make and having the wrong, you know, having nobody to help them, having nobody to support them. What I want to say from that point is it's okay. It is absolutely okay to make shit decisions, and it is okay to fail at stuff, and it is okay to, you know, not know if you're doing the right thing. It's unforgivable to not learn from those things. And it took me a long time to learn from those things. But that's what those mistakes and problems and errors and massive fuck ups are there to do. They are there to teach you, to help you not do those things again. And have I stopped making mistakes? Absolutely not. Do I still make mistakes? Absolutely. Am I getting much better at not making mistakes? Absolutely. Do I understand my path and my destination a bit better? Yes. Do I have a 10-year plan now? Absolutely not. 3 to 5 year plan maybe, but still that's slightly fuzzy. I'm still going to make mistakes, right? And it's okay to do that. It's okay to not listen to the business. It's okay to listen to the business coaches and go, how do I do that? I can't suddenly be like these, you know, people that you see doing motivational talks on Instagram and Facebook and sharing their stories and all those kind of things. We can't all be like that. That's just not the reality. What we can do is learn from the mistakes that we make and learn from the mistakes that other people make and start mitigating future mistakes. And start growing in ourselves and learning and improving and accepting of the fuck ups that we've made in the past, and accepting that that was our fault, even if it wasn't wholly your fault, but accepting that it was partly your fault, and accepting your responsibility for this whole thing. At the end of the day, I got into business with the wrong people. I didn't do my due diligence. I didn't understand where I was going. I was reliant on thinking that simply by creating a partnership, I was going to create something good. And life doesn't work like that. And that's probably the most important lesson, or the lessons that four lessons that I wanted to take out of that history. So just to very quickly finish off, I went out, consulted after I sold my business. I did that for a certain amount of time. I met my business partner, Matt. We merged our brains. We put a business together. We've been building SEMO ever since. I am 99.99. I'm 100% certain that Matt is the right person for me to be working with, without a doubt. He offers various things, a huge amount of things that I don't have. And I hope I offer things that he doesn't have. And we complement each other perfectly because we're very different people. Are we friends? No. Do we socialize at the weekends? No. Do we work well together? Absolutely. That's my first lesson out of all of this, is that work with the right people, take time, use your due diligence, ask people, interview people, get nothing is happening. Nothing is going to happen in your life without the right people. Even the athletes in the world that, you know, the basketball players, the famous basketball players, the Michael Jordans of this world, they were surrounded by the right people, the right teammates, the right coaches, the right support staff. That's how they became, that's how they got to where they got to, by being surrounded with the right people. The right people is such a important part of your business. And if you're sitting there listening to this and looking at your business partner or looking at the people that are working for you and going, they aren't the right people, do something about it. You don't have to do something about it today, but realize that you have to do something about it, because that's what needs to change in your business. That's what needs to change in your life as well. It's not just the right people when it comes to business, but it's the right people that you have, that your friends, your partners. You are, one of my favorite quotes, you are a combination of the six people that you hang around with the most, or that you spend the most time with. That's who you are. So for God's sake, make those six people really good people. Make those six people better than you. I met the guy who spoke at Eagle Boys, who used to own Eagle Boys Pizza. I never remember his name. And I remember him saying he knew nothing about business, but he surrounded himself with people who knew more than he did about the areas that the business needed. That's the key, is surround yourself with the right people. Get into business with the right people. That's my first lesson. The second lesson is, you don't have to have a plan. There doesn't have to be a great idea, a great scheme. There doesn't have to be a destination. You don't have to know what you're going to do in the next 10 years. You don't have to be Lou Jury. Again, this is not a criticism of Lou Jury. He's a vastly successful person. I love what he's done in business, but you don't have to be Lou Jury. At most, you need a 90-day plan. What are the things you're going to achieve in the next 90 days? Focus on that first. Don't worry about what the fuck you're doing in the next 10 years. You don't have to have a plan. The most important thing is for you to start doing something. Start doing something and making mistakes. Move fast and break stuff. Who was that? I think that was Steve Jobs who said that. And that's the key. You know, do something. Do something, test it, adjust and improve. Do something else, adjust it, test and improve. You know, that's the process. It's just, you can build the plan out later. I seem to remember a guy who founded Uber, Travis, can't remember his name. The guy who founded Uber, I remember him reading an article about him, was that he went out, he designed all of the screens for the Uber app, and he had no business plan. There was no funding. There was nothing. He just designed all the screens for the Uber business app on one of those online design tools, and just started showing people. He goes, what do you think of this? Do you think you'd hire a car? Do you think you'd use Uber if this is what it looked like? He was testing it. He was testing the idea. You know, you don't have to have a long-term plan. He didn't know what Uber was going to merge, you know, evolve into in the years, or maybe he did, but you know, at that point he didn't. He was just going, I'm just going to test this idea. So that's the second point out of this, is you don't have to have a plan. I'm fucking rolling about on the floor in Leicester Square in Haymarket of Piccadilly Circus. There was no plan there. There was one plan, but that never happened with that girl. But there was no plan. There was no business plan. I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't know where I was going. I didn't know I was going to meet an Australian girl in a nightclub and end up marrying her and moving back to this country. None of that. There was no plan there. And yes, could it have turned out better for me earlier on? You know, not going to talk about my brother, but my brother has always had a plan, or seems to have always had a plan, and things are absolutely, he's extremely successful. But you don't have to have a plan. The third lesson out of all of this is not knowing how a business, you have to know how a business works. You don't have to have a plan, but you have to know how a business works. I used to watch Dragon's Den, the UK version of Dragon's Den, and there was the Scottish guy on there, Duncan. He said the quote, revenue is vanity, profit is sanity, cash is reality. Know how a business works and know what your numbers are, know what your money is, okay? It's all well and good you counting revenue at the top of things, but that doesn't matter. Profit is the key. How much profit is your business making? If your business isn't making that much profit, is it because you're reinvesting it in the business to grow the business? That's okay. But profit is sanity. Cash, what is in the bank so that you can pay your staff, that is the reality. That is the important number. So the revenue and the profit are completely it just doesn't matter. Cash is what is important. The last one, my point, is don't let your ego get in the way. The irony of someone like me telling that is quite amusing. Another story that I'm going to kind of finish up with about that ego. And sometimes it can be good for you. Sometimes it can be bad for you. And this is one of those stories that I go, I don't know whether this is good or bad for me. In fact, I know it was good for me. And I know my ego was secretly trying to save me from a fate worse than death. I had had my first son. I think he was about 1.5 at the time. And I was out consulting, and a company, an agency approached me and said, can you come and be our head of digital or our digital director or something? They said, you can name your own position title. And they'd come to me and I'd gone, oh, how much are you going to pay me? And they were going to pay me $150K. And that was actually less at the time than I was making as a consultant. But I went to my wife and I said, what do you think? And she just looked at me and just went, take the job. And I was like, why? She went, regular money. We have a son. You need a job. You know, your consulting is irregular. You may get a good gig. You may not get a good gig. You may lose a gig tomorrow. And I was like, I kind of knew she was right. But also, you know, she was nervous. She was worried. She's like, she was working. We had a son. Yeah, I get why she made that call. And I'd gone back to them and said, I don't really want to do this. They'd offered me a lower amount first. I was like, I don't really want to do this. It's a lot less than I'm earning. And they put the money up and I took the job. But I'd already said no. And then they convinced me otherwise. And I lasted 3 months before they fired me. And this is where the ego comes into it, because after I left there, I was telling people, oh yeah, we kind of, you know, we left by, or I quit, or we left by a mutual agreement. They didn't, they fired me. And they fired me simply because I'd gone in there that day, or I'd gone in there in those 3 months and hadn't done what they'd wanted me to do. They wanted me to write proposals. And I was like, yeah, I'd spent 6 years writing proposals. I'm not writing any more proposals. They wanted me to work, this seems fairly pointless, but they wanted me to work till 5:30 every day on the dot. Like, nobody was allowed to leave the office till 5:30. And anyone that did had to ask permission, and was frowned upon if they were leaving at before 5:30. And I was one of those, and the point was that they didn't actually start until 9:30. No, started at 9, finished at 5:30. And I'm one of those people that I used to get into the office at 7:30 and leave at 3:30, 4 o'clock, early in, early out. So I kind of wanted to keep those same hours, but all of a sudden it's being frowned upon, even though I was, and I couldn't get in there any earlier because I didn't have keys. The office wasn't open. I was a new guy, so they weren't giving me a set of keys. Yeah, I just didn't fit in. I'd run my own business for 6-7 years, and all of a sudden I'm now taking orders from somebody else. And I was the wrong person, square peg, round hole. It was just an abomination. And the relief the day they fired me, I was like, oh, thank fucking God. And I don't know why, I pleaded for my job in that meeting when they fired me. They took me to a cafe and gave me a talking to. We're going to let you go. And I was like, there was, I think, 1 day or 2 days left of my, your trial period. And they fired me, and I argued. I said, no, you don't want me. You want me to give me more responsibility, and I can do this and this and this. And I was like, in my head saying that, and almost I could feel the rest of me trying to kick me and go, shut the fuck up, go. And funnily enough, I walked out of there. I'd maintained one of my clients over the time when I was a consultant, and I carried on working there. So I went back, was still getting a consultancy gig, picked up another couple of clients, and everything worked out fine. But that ego moment where I was like, no, I can't be fired, or, you know, how dare you fire me? And then afterwards turning around and saying to people, no, I quit. I quit because it was a terrible place to work, or I quit because whatever reason, or we left a mutual agreement, and it was all bollocks. They fired me. They'd started recruiting someone in the middle of November already. 6 weeks into me being there, they'd already started trying to recruit someone else to do the role, with a view that they were going to fire me. It was a moment when I suddenly went, yeah, this isn't, again, it was another affirmation of the fact that I shouldn't have been working for someone else. That's not what I wanted to do. I wanted to build something myself. I wanted to be my own boss. I wanted to work on the direction and have make the decisions myself. That's what I wanted to do. But the ego almost got in the way there. The ego made me beg for a job, beg for my job, beg me for not be fired, beg me to get fucking promoted and paid more, saying I could do this. I think we should do this. I think we should restructure like this. The ego made me beg for the job, and the ego afterwards made me deny that I'd been fired. And I look back and go, what the fuck were you doing? You need to be honest. You need to be clear. You need to be radical honesty. Ray Dalio, and his book talks about radical transparency, radical honesty, and all those kind of things. And that's what you need. You see, if something is shit, or if you don't agree with something, you need to say it. And the best thing you can do is have that radical transparency and radical honesty with yourself. Because if you can't do it with yourself, then you sure as shit shouldn't be doing it with anybody else. Those are my four lessons. I'll repeat them again. You don't have to have a plan. You need to work with the right people. You need to understand how a business works. And you need to stop letting your ego make decisions for you. Those are perhaps the four things that I have picked up out of that story that I've just told you. There is, hopefully, fingers crossed, touch wood, something else. There is still a lot more for this story to be told. There are multiple other areas that I've failed and made poor decisions and done the wrong thing. Not necessarily done the wrong thing, but not done the right thing. Places where I have made terrible decisions about in my relationship with my parents sometimes. I look back on those now and I go, if I was my parents, I'd have disowned me at some point, you know, but they didn't. And I love them and thank them for that. But I just wanted to reiterate at the end of this that, and if you're still listening, then fucking congratulations for listening. And if you are still listening by the end of this, 1 hour and 18 minutes in, please send me an email at simon@simo.com to let me know that you've listened all the way through, because I'll be amazed. I would genuinely be amazed if you've listened all the way through. But I just want to hopefully say this to the people who are working in any management role, who are working in marketing, who own their own business, who are running their own business and are stressed and are concerned, are watch too much Gary Vee and think that they should be hustling more, or watching too much Tony Robbins and thinking that they should have a vision. And, oh, look, just don't worry about it. It is not, you cannot beat yourself up about it. What you can do and what you should do is day to day make small, single, incremental improvements in your life, not radical ones, not massive changes. Read a book. I think that's the thing that one of the things I've learned in the last 3 years is read more books. That's probably lesson number five, right? Read more books. That's a cheap and easy $20, $30 a month way to learn more, improve yourself. There is huge amounts of books out there that you can read. Use audiobooks. Get Audible. It's $15 a month. There is no excuse that you shouldn't be listening to something in the car as you're driving about. But I guess my final point is don't worry. Don't, and I know it's hard to someone to say don't worry, but you can get better. Running a business, you can improve in running a business. You can improve in becoming more smart about running a business. You can get better at doing these things. It is not impossible. And if you need to ask somebody something, if you need to talk about something, if you feel like you can't deal with something, please, 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 please email me, simon@cemoh.com, cemoh.com. Email me, tell me your problems. We can Zoom, we can phone call, we can share emails. You don't have to talk to me. We just share emails. Tell me what the problem is. And I guarantee you, whatever the problem is, even if I can't solve it, I know somebody else that will be able to help solve it for you. and help talk you through what you need to do. And I can tell you this now, that if in that 6 years of running Two Cents, I'd had somebody on my side that could tell me what I was doing wrong because they'd already done it wrong, I would have been in a much, much better place after that. My ego would have stood in the way of me listening, and that's another matter entirely. But I have made some monumental fuck-ups in many, many areas of my life, right? If you think you are going to make fuck-ups, or you are making fuck-ups and don't want to make any more fuck-ups, talk to me and I will help you out. So please send me an email. I will do my best to respond in 24 hours. That's pretty much it. The podcasts after this will go back to their normal service, in which we talk to people that are substantially more interesting and successful than I am. And I hope you enjoy them. As I say, if you have made it this far into the podcast, then good on you. Get yourself a drink, a glass of wine, sit down. You deserve it. But probably most of all, thank you for listening, because I certainly didn't expect you to. And if you have, I appreciate it. Thank you.